So welcome along to Wednesday night. We're doing this course called Presenting the Path. So welcome along, those in class and those online. So we begin as we normally do. We'll take refuge together. We'll do a small meditation. Then we'll begin the class proper. And in the class proper, there's a part for questions that you can ask and also for us to meditate. So let's begin. So everyone needs to be just really comfortable in their seats. So ideally, this would mean that your back is straight and your shoulders relaxed. Your feet are either flat on the floor or on a cushion. And your head is balanced evenly upon the neck. And you can either have your eyes closed or partially open, whatever suits. And when you feel quite comfortable in your posture, just allow the body to breathe itself. And while the body continues to breathe itself, you can imagine that in the space in front of you and slightly above your eyebrows appears Shakyamuni Buddha. And his body is made of golden light, and he is sitting on a throne of gold. And the Buddha is surrounded by your spiritual mentors, teachers of the lineage, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and other meditational deities. And I'd like you to imagine that you are surrounded by all sentient beings. These will include your parents, your family, people you have difficulties with, and strangers. And everyone is just like you, facing the Buddha and his entourage. You recollect your purpose for being here and summoning the Buddha and the spiritual entourage. So think that you wish to put an end to the suffering of yourself and others. And you want to develop all of your good qualities and help others do the same. And it's for these reasons that you've turned in the safe direction, or towards the safe direction of the Buddha, the Dharma, and his spiritual community. And so you say, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through receiving the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through the sins of the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through the sins of the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. So, in response to this wish of ours, think that lights and nectars stream forth from the heart of each enlightened being above you. And these wash over yourself and over all the people surrounding you. And whatever obstacles and difficulties you have in spiritual practice are removed. And your potentials of method and wisdom are empowered. And you recollect the four immeasurable thoughts of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. You decide to develop these yourself and help everyone else do the same. To affirm this, you say, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. In response to this, we should ask again, lights and nectar stream forth from the heart of each enlightened being above you. They wash over you and over everyone surrounding you. And these four immeasurable qualities effortlessly manifest. And you recollect the field of merit, and you prepare yourself to purify the mind, to accumulate merit, and to increase the merit. Now the Buddha and his spiritual companions reappear as a field of merit, and you say to them, reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, action, and momentum. I declare all my negative actions, accumulated since the beginning of time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cycle existence and turn the wheel of Dharma from living beings. I dedicate my own and other spirits to the great enlightenment. Now, we rent ourselves from clinging to our practice to be truly existent. We recollect emptiness, the ultimate nature of all phenomena, which is that it lacks any true existence but does exist dependently. We think that our body, speech, and mind are all the merit we've created, and every object of our senses is utterly transformed and reappears as a pure land. This is pure land that we're going to offer to the field of merit. And so we say, this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, sun and moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field of offering. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratnam Dandakamaya Chayam. So you've released the offering, and the Buddha accepts it with delight, and he smiles at you, and you look up and you meet his gaze. And looking into the gaze of the Buddha, you feel as if all your aspirations have been recognized and accepted. And so you feel at ease. And then an emanation of the Buddha leaves his heart. It moves through space and comes to the bottom of the crown of your head, facing in the same direction you are. Now the emanation begins to descend down to the level of your heart, whereby its radiance expands, filling your body and mind with lights and nectars. Stream out through the pores of your skin, filling the 10 directions of space, and establishing every being within space to now be within the enlightened state. I think you've accomplished your own purpose and the purpose of others. And within the absence of intrinsic nature, you hear the mantra of the Buddha resounding, and you begin to join in reciting it. Taya Dham Mahamudra. So just recite this a few times underneath your breath. Tata Om Muni Muni Maha Munaya Soha. Now the light rays begin to withdraw from the 10 directions of space and they re-enter your heart. You can hear the sounds of traffic, you can feel the seat beneath you. And you recognize that this brief meditation was one of imagination. But nevertheless, it has imprinted the mind with what you've done. And so this imprinting will act as a condition for your eventual awakening, whereby you will be able to benefit all sentient beings. But this awakening, of course, depends upon much practice, much reflection, and much meditation. And I think if you wish to discover every element and aspect of the path, you want to develop it to bring about your own welfare and the welfare of all beings. And breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth, and let your eyes flutter open, move your body, and just bring your awareness back to the room. Okay, so this is a class six of this unit. So we've covered a number of different phenomena. We began by looking at our Buddhist history. We looked at how it was developed in India, then moved to Tibet and then to different countries throughout the world. Then we looked at the a hagiography of the Buddha. And this hagiography is demonstrated through the 12 deeds. So remember, a hagiography is not a biography or a history. It's more like a spiritual biography. It's really there to inspire people like ourselves and anybody else interested in this particular path. Then we looked at the six beneficial ways of listening and the three wrong ways to listen. And throughout our course, we'll be looking at the foundation of all good qualities and its outline. This foundation of all good qualities is made up of what they call the three scopes or three capacities of spiritual practitioners. So we've looked at the small capacity and we've looked at the middling capacity. And so today we'll be looking at the great capacity. To help me explain this to you, I've relied upon these particular books. So some of them have got, what's particularly good about the material here is it's got a commentary on the foundation of all good qualities. It's also got commentaries on the three principal aspects of the path. And these two come together very well. And there's quite a few questions in these units about either the three scopes or the three principal aspects. So today I'm going to be going through these three principal aspects just briefly and then introduce the practices for a person of great capacity. And we'll look at verse 7 of the foundation of all good qualities. I'm going to basically answer sort of five questions that I'm meant to do. So these questions are, we're going to find out, for instance, what the three principal aspects of the path are, how these relate to the three scopes, and the relationship between renunciation, bodhicitta, knowing what bodhicitta is and how you... Remember, bodhicitta is just a Sanskrit word for mind of enlightenment. So here are the three principal aspects. We have, first of all, what we normally use the term renunciation. I think the way Tibetan Buddhists talk about it is called a definite intention to leave. So the place to live, what they want to leave is samsara. So it's a definitive way of being. You realize that samsara doesn't actually work and you want to get out, you want to be free of it. The other principal aspect is the mind of enlightenment, what called bodhicitta. So this gives us a wish to be free of samsara but to help everybody else also be friendly. And you understand the only way you can actually do this is to attain enlightenment yourself. So you have a really deep, strong wish to become enlightened for the benefit of all beings. And this is called bodhicitta. But this wish is not enough to bring about your freedom. And neither is the wish to this renunciation, which is not enough either to bring about liberation from cyclic existence. But what you need in both instances here, if you wish to achieve these goals, is what they call the correct view. And the correct view from the middle way consequence position is the negation of inherent existence. When you negate inherent existence, you realize that all phenomena are actually empty of the true existence they seem to have. And so the phenomena exist as dependent arisings. And most importantly, phenomena exist, the way that things exist is through dependent designation. This is the most subtle view, and this is the view that frees you from psychic existence. Now, this question is asked about if you have bodhicitta, do you have renunciation? That was really, when you have renunciation, your wish here is just for freedom from psychic existence, for yourself, it's for your personal freedom. Bodhicitta is you have that wish, but you've extended it out to others, and you've seen, wow, everybody's just like me, everybody's trapped. So I need to free them as well as myself. To do that, I need to have to become a Buddha. The question is basically, is renunciation within the mind of enlightenment? And in brief, the answer is yes, it is. So why or how? So when we look at renunciation, we're focused upon our own freedom. We want, and the freedom we're talking about here is the freedom from the disturbing emotions and how they keep you locked into this cycle of an uncontrolled existence. So renunciation, it was our own freedom. And like I said, renunciation is really a look at how much suffering you go through and bringing compassion towards yourself. And think, like, I've got to be free of this. I've got to stop this. So it requires you to look very deeply into the nature of your own suffering. With an understanding that you could be free of it. Because if you couldn't be free of it, it's not a good idea. Right? As Holmes has often said, you need sort of a big view, you need to get an overview first and go, well, is it possible to be free? If you see, if you agree, I can see, yes, it is possible, and then I want to be free. This is, you have renunciation there. This is just on your own singular purpose, your own singular freedom. But of course, you can look around, you can see your brothers and sisters, your parents, anybody you know, and you're going to go, like, oh, we're all in the same boat. But perhaps many of them don't know about this. Perhaps they don't know that you can actually be free. As I do. So I need to share what I know. And I've got to do the very best I can to break free from cyclic existence. But it's only with that you can actually free people. Now, this does not mean to say just because we haven't got renunciation, we should not help others. No, we need to keep helping others as best we can. While we're alive. So when we have this other's freedom, now we're into a bodhicitta. So like I said, it depends upon us extending our understanding and our realizations of our own deepest suffering. So we take the compassion we feel towards ourselves and our own suffering, and then go, okay, it's the same with Madonna, it's the same with Ben. We're all the same here. So seeing that we're the same, I need to do what I do. What I do for you is what I do for me. Right? There's no real difference here. Like I said, we're the same here. So there are a lot of analysis you can do to really see this sameness. You know, like for instance, we're all the same in that we we grasp that inherent existence where there is none. We're all the same, and that there is no self-sufficient, substantially distant self within us. You know, we're all the same, that we don't inherently exist. We're all the same, that we suffer. We're all the same, that we are impermanent. Yeah. So, of course, there are many differences between us too, but here we're really looking at sameness. Because it's by seeing the sameness you can sort of go, okay, then in the same way I work for myself, I need to work for you too. If you ask yourself, why don't I? It's an interesting question, isn't it? If we're all the same, why do I just work for me and not for you? And so, in brief, renunciation is subsumed within the mind of enlightenment. If you have the mind of enlightenment, you have renunciation. Because to become enlightened, you have to abandon the causes of suffering. And that's exactly what the person does who wants to be liberated themselves. They have to abandon the causes of suffering. That's what it's the same. Now, we've been going over the three scopes or the three capacities of a spiritual person. And we know that they're basically called the small scope, the middling scope, and the great scope. So what's this person who has a small capacity to practice? What's their goal?
To have a fortunate human rebirth.
To have a fortunate human rebirth and to avoid lower realm rebirth. Yeah, so you can always sit with one of them as they go like that. Okay, now we've got a person of middling scope. So what's their goal? What do they abandon and what do they have to do to achieve their goal? So what do they abandon, first of all?
Samsara.
Yeah, samsara, the whole of samsara, right? Everything that causes samsara, they want to abandon that. What do they need to, how do they need to act? What are their practices to achieve this liberated state they're seeking called nirvana?
Three higher trainings.
Excellent. Three higher trainings. This is right. And the three higher trainings are higher ethics, concentration, and higher wisdom, isn't it? So let's have a look and see how they're related. So we've got small scope. They have an authentic, partial renunciation. What are they renouncing? Stuff on lower realms. I don't want to go, neither should we, right? But nothing to do with it. We don't want to find ourselves there. And what do they rely upon? The correct mundane view. Does anyone know what the correct mundane view is? Yeah, the Buddhist teachings of cause and effect, karmic cause and effect. That's the mundane, correct mundane view. Now we have those of middling scope. Remember, their goal is liberation or nirvana. So they have an authentic and it's an uncontrived, complete renunciation. What uncontrived means here, it does not rely upon you using reasoning to have to wish to be free. Yeah, why? Because you've done all that reasoning before. You're so familiar with the reasoning, that it's certain in yourself that, well, I want out. And what does that depend upon? Now, it depends upon the super mundane correct view. And what's the super mundane correct view?
Emptiness.
The wisdom realizing emptiness. That's right. Now we have the person of great view or great capacity, sorry. And they have what they call an uncontrived bodhicitta or an uncontrived mind of enlightenment. Now, before they have the uncontrived mind of enlightenment, they need a contrived mind of enlightenment, which means you do all the reasoning. You go through the six causes and one effect, but equalize the exchange of self and others, you put them together, it's all reason, until like it comes to like, I must become enlightened to benefit all. And that no longer requires your thinking. This the example I often give is, you know, when you first, you decide you want to own a car and drive it, you know, there's a lot of thinking that goes on about that, isn't it? There's a lot of sort of knowledge, it takes time. I remember doing this, I never completed it. I was looking at the driving code and going through it all and going, oh my God, like, this is too much.
Right? Learn the rules.
There are so many rules, and you've got to, and then you have to remember it, don't you? So you can't sit in the car and pull out the book. So you don't pull out the book because it's become uncontrived, like you know it deeply. So now later on, when you get in the car, you just drive it, there's a real good at it. But for me, it wouldn't be like that at all. I'd be saying, what do you do first? Oh, yeah, you've got to do this. And now what? Now I do that. So that's all, that's what we call a contrived mind. And of course, you can go beyond it and become uncontrived. So an uncontrived mind of enlightenment and a super mundane correct view. Again, this is the wisdom realizing emptiness. But all phenomena exist dependent upon awareness and name. And also, if you wish to become enlightened in what they call a single lifetime, then you need to enter the paths of Tantra. So that to do that, that requires initiation. And I hope you can sort of see some sort of correlation here between these three scopes, which are down the bottom, and then of course these the principal aspects, renunciation, bodhicitta, and the correct view. Okay, so now we can have a look at this, the stages of practice for those of great capacity. And this verse, verse 7, that's going to be coming up, really just deals with one aspect of it. It's called the wishing mind of enlightenment. The bodhicitta can be broken up in a number of different ways. The one we're going to look at today is called wishing bodhicitta. Next week, we look at engaging bodhicitta. They're both minds of enlightenment, but they're a little different. Other ways of looking at bodhicitta, of course, is conventional and ultimate. Let's have a look here at what Lama Atisha says. So as you can see, his verse says, one who wholly seeks a complete end to the entire suffering of others, because their suffering belongs to his own conscious stream. That person is a superior. One who wholly seeks a complete end to the entire suffering of others, because their suffering belongs to his own conscious stream, that person is a superior. So what's this actually sort of mean? It means that the person's first of all looked at their own suffering, and they go, okay, that's my nature. Then he looks at everyone else and, oh my gosh, their nature is just the same as mine. So theirs is no different than mine. So I carry on my mind stream that all these people are suffering. And I know that freedom is possible. So I'm going to work for their freedom. If you look at the Arahat has greater wisdom than the Bodhisattva up to the eighth ground, right? As soon as the Bodhisattva achieves the eighth ground, now they have the same wisdom. They both realize selflessness there. But the wisdom is slightly different from the Bodhisattva because there are different means of achieving that wisdom. They're so varied. But if you achieve liberation, you don't need to have all those different methods. They just require, basically one. To realize your own selflessness. That's it. But the bodhisattva has to be much more. And that's why you have a look at different texts like Nagarjuna's Rules of Wisdom. Man, there's like 27 different ways of finding that phenomena all empty. So he just goes through everything. It's like any sort of phenomena you think is conventionally existent, you go, okay, that's empty. This is how you discover it. So a multitude of ways. So that wisdom is much what they call like greater in the sense of the methods used to realize the greater. And so basically here, so while most people only care for their own circle, meaning those close to you, this person, meaning the person who's developed a mind of enlightenment and intends to, has expanded the boundaries of their own heart or mind. They realize that suffering is a problem to be solved regardless of whose mind it appears in. Since every human being wants to be happy and to avoid pain just as we do, the superior person views the hardships of others as their responsibility. They see all beings as part of one vast, interconnected life stream. And so here's one of the sayings from the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. He says, so think of your own body. Now, if you stub your toe, your hand immediately reaches down to rub it. You do not ask, why should I help that toe? Right? I'm a hand. And that's a foot. Why don't you help that? Yeah. So he says, you act because the pain exists within your shared life. Like anybody's ever had a relationship or a child, right? When your partner suffers or your children suffer, you suffer.
Yeah.
It's like, it's like their suffering belongs to your own stream, isn't it? So is there anything else you'd like to mention about what we've just covered so far? I think the simple explanation is just habit. And we've been habituated to just caring for those like ourselves and those really close to us, and maybe a little bit further, and that's just the way we've been habituated. And if you can look at the habit, and then of course is what we call self-grasping ignorance. So we actually feel as if we are different than everybody else. Right? And so, like I said, the differences become greater. If they're not our family, if they're not my close friends, well, the difference is so great, like I don't care, basically. Yeah, so we've got self-grasping, self-cherishing, and just the habit. Let's do our first meditation then. So, just adjust your posture to once again feel comfortable in the seat. Elongate the spine and drop the shoulders. And just check to see how your head is balanced upon your neck. Again, either close your eyes completely or just partially. And breathing deeply, let your mind be calm and still. And then altruistically, set your heart on being free. Because this meditation is for yourself and for all living beings. So think about ending every type of pain and suffering. This starts by facing your own quiet and hidden hurts. True care for others grows when your wish for peace embraces all beings. We can't lift others up while we still drag around our own heavy chains. Like a person who swims the shore first, you have to reach safe ground before you can help. So why might letting go be the first step on the path of a true renunciate? Gives you the will to break free from the cycle of dissatisfaction and pain. The focus required, though, is like being a person in a cell, a prison cell, who thinks of nothing but the door opening. So how might your own freedom grow into a love and concern that embraces all living beings? This takes place when you see that all beings are caught in the same fog of confusion and loss as we are. And this love is very much like a mother who sees each person as her own dear child. So what arrives when your personal freedom is conjoined with the wish to help every other living being? Self-grasping and self-cherishing fall away. And their absence becomes like a light for all living beings. This is very much like the sun that burns the cold mist from the dark valleys at dawn. So when you go home this evening and you see others, recognize that these people are seeking peace. They're seeking an absence of pain and suffering, just as you are. Recognize your equanimity, the equality between yourself and others. And decide, just as I will help myself, I will help the other. Breathing in through your nostrils, just exhale through your mouth. So now I'm going to have a look, bring into these teachings a couple of verses from the three principal aspects of the path, and then we'll come into verse 7 of the foundation. So this verse deals with the importance of the mind of enlightenment and what its foundation is. So here Lama Tsongkhapa says, unless it's driven by pure bodhicitta, renunciation will never become a cause for the perfect happiness of highest enlightenment. Therefore, intelligent beings cultivate supreme bodhicitta. Basically, sort of say that if the renunciation you've developed is not accompanied by a mind that seeks the welfare of all beings, you will not be able to achieve Buddhahood. You will attain like liberation, you could do that, but this is the state of Buddha, state of personal liberation is quite different from the state of Buddhahood. And basically the verse is saying, but while seeking personal peace is a necessary foundation, only an altruistic motivation provides the expansive energy and wisdom required for the highest state of human evolution, Buddhahood. There's quite a big discussion about this, right? So some of the, you know, the, from the bodhisattva's point of view, from that thing, they look back and they say, you know, like, you haven't accomplished as much as you could. And so the person who is the arahant, the person who has achieved their personal liberation, what they have on their mental continuum are called cognitive obscurations. And when you have these cognitive obscurations, you don't have the power or the wherewithal to become fully awakened. So you brought about your, you know, what you thought, So you abide in a state of peace. But from the Bodhisattva perspective, they look back and say, well, you haven't accomplished everything. Like, yeah, you've accomplished your purpose, but what about everybody else? And the story goes that so these people, the arahats, right, and they don't take rebirth again in conscious existence. Now, they call the foe destroyed, so they've destroyed the foe. They abide in the state of first wish, they're no longer in cyclic existence. They cannot take rebirth into the cyclic existence. So the Buddhas, those who have achieved enlightenment themselves, right, they know these people who have achieved that state of freedom. And now what they're going to do is they come along and go, hey, I know you, it feels fantastic in that state of peace, you've achieved it, but I need to wake you up to the suffering of everybody else. And you need to come back and help these people.
So what is the connection then between pure bodhicitta and cognitive obscuration?
So pure bodhicitta, in this case, I guess I'm going to infer what you mean by that, and if I'm wrong, let me know yet, right? Pure bodhicitta here is just it's this uncontrived wish to become enlightened.
Yeah.
Is that what you mean by pure bodhicitta?
Yeah.
Okay. So you have that, right? So this person needs to conjoin it with the wisdom realizing emptiness. So when you say with the cognitive obscurations, they can't be that, meaning the body bodhisattvas or the arahats.
Why
an
individual?
Yeah. So the bodhisattva, so we'll do the grounds and paths, right? So from the middle way consequence point of view, they've got 10 grounds to go through. But so what that means is they realize emptiness and they keep practicing and they keep going up through different levels. And as they go through the levels, different obscurations are removed. This is the same as the arahats, the people on the paths of personal liberation. So both are going up, up, up like that, removing different types of afflictive obscurations. The arahat achieves his goal, right? Bang. So now he's free of these afflictive obscurations, but he still has the cognitive obscurations because he's never done anything about them. The bodhisattva comes up at the eighth ground. He now has removed all of his afflictive obscurations, but he's still got cognitive obscurations and he knows it. So from 8, 9, 10th grounds, he's working to free himself of those. At the 10th ground, he achieves Buddhahood. No more cognitive obscurations. So they achieve Buddhahood. Whereas the others, because they have cognitive obscurations, but no afflictive obscurations, they achieve the state of an arahat or liberation. So if you think about it, renunciation is just about you. So all the energy is for you, your freedom. But if you're working for the freedom of all beings, man, you need a lot of energy, right, to do that, don't you? So this bodhicitta gives you that. It's like, you know, it's like taking everybody's, well, in a way, and you can do this, it's like everybody is me. There's no difference between me and you.
I just had a question, why not have what would be wrong with, like, say, 100 people becoming Buddhas, and then just everyone else becomes arhats? Based on their
Is that okay? So everybody, right? There are no sentient beings left. Well, then the Buddhas don't need to awaken them because there are no sentient beings to be saved, do they? I would think that's not. No, we're only doing just sentient beings. So one of the things about this, the difference between the arahat and the bodhisattva, is that in the short term, it looks like the arahat has so much less to do because they do that. They're only concerned about their own freedom, right? So, you know, it takes however long it takes to get there. And meanwhile, bodhisattva gets up there and he's got to keep working, doesn't he? He's like, oh, man, it takes a long time. And you go, yeah, that's true. But now think about this. While you're just sitting here in peace, this guy's working, and he gets up the top and he goes, hey, buddy. Wake up. Now they got to go on So now all that time they could have been working for it and they haven't been, now that takes a long time there. So it says, if you're intelligent, start from the beginning. Go for the mind of enlightenment. Okay, so now we're talking about this, the advanced level of practitioner. So their direct aim, of course, as you know, is called full awakening or Buddhahood. In other words, it's even called enlightenment, but then it's got to be called great enlightenment because the arahats are also enlightened. They call it the smaller enlightenment. But basically, we just go Buddhahood, enlightenment, or omniscience. That's their goal. Now, how do they achieve that goal? They practice the six perfections, the four ways of gathering disciples, and they enter the path of the Dharma. And what are they trying to eliminate? The cognitive obscurations. Of course, they're also doing the afflictive obscurations, but the major thing here, and the most difficult, is cognitive obscurations, which are basically the latencies of the afflictions. And they're also trying to remove the appearance of inherent existence. So now, what's bodhicitta? How do we define it? Are you guys okay with the writing? Sometimes I go a bit fast, and it's like, oh my gosh. So I'll give you two definitions of it. And we're going to look at the long one tonight, and then other times we'll look at the brief and the short. So looking at the mind of enlightenment, the brief or the short is wishing to attain enlightenment for the benefit of others, or for the benefit of others, wishing to attain enlightenment. Well, that's pretty easy to remember, isn't it? So here's the longer definition, which has got much more involved. So it says this. It is a special mental main mind, which is the entryway to the Mahayana path. So it's special because it's one of the principal states of awareness required to attain enlightenment. And it's a mental consciousness, so it's not a sense consciousness. And it is a main mind. So when we look at mind, we can look at minds from the perspective of main minds and mental factors. But this is a main mind. So think, well, I'm looking at this and go, right, so I work this out, go, main mind, hang on, there's only six of them. You know, we've got visual consciousness, auditory consciousness, and then you've got mental consciousness, isn't it? So which one's it going to be? Well, you know, it can't be any of the sense consciousnesses, so that means only mental consciousness. So in other words, the mental consciousness that you have right now, that's going to turn into a mind that seeks enlightenment. That's its major impetus. You know, like, you know, we talked to David about going to work, right? And you think, yeah, I've got to go to work. Why did you say it? For money? Yeah? This is a driving thing. I've got to get the money, so I've got to go to work. Yeah? That's this other one's like, I've got to get enlightened. But that's the whole way you're going through life. It's like this, I don't know, you probably don't know. You might have seen films of this or read books where people have been imprisoned. Oh, Papillon. Anyone see that film or read the book, Papillon? Yeah. So this guy, no matter what prison they put him in, he always tried to escape. Always. Freedom was on his mind all the time. Right? He had to get out. Then they put him on this island for these people that were like that. Right? They kept on this island. I think it was just him and one other person. And it was like no way off the island. The island was this massive steep cliffs. And they left him there, that was it. Didn't stop him. He knew he had to get off, but he had to be free. So he studied the tides, right? And then left off. Got back to France and then did what he wanted to do. Yeah? But it's that sort of thing. It's your driving impetus. I think, now they often compare mind of enlightenment to the mother's care for her child. I think that's got to be real close to it. This is the major thing, isn't it? Mother gives birth to a child, man, the most important, it's not the husband anymore, it's my kid. Everything's about that. So it's the same with the mind of the moment. Everything is about becoming free to benefit others. And this, when you have it, now you've entered the Mahayana path. Without it, you haven't. So that's the entryway to the Mahayana path. Then it says, and is concomitant with its assistant aspiration. It focuses on complete enlightenment for the benefit of others. Now, this concomitant with its assisted aspiration. So the assisted aspiration, in other words, you've got these two reasons for becoming enlightened. One is with great compassion for everybody who's suffering. And the other is Buddha. A wish to become a Buddha or a wish to become fully enlightened. Why? Because of the suffering of all beings. So there's two aspects of mind here. One is saying yes, all beings are suffering. You can see this when you look at this six causes of one effect meditation. Right? You go up and say, wow, I can see all beings are suffering and I am too. And then you're going to go, well, what can you do about it? Yeah, so you go, well, got to become enlightened. So that's just, the other aspiration. I want to become enlightened. Why? I want to free all beings from suffering. So two aspirations there, two aspects. And they make up this, they come together, and then you have this mind, or bodhicitta. So here's a bit more about the advanced level of practitioner, the bodhisattva. So you know, to have that type of motivation, you need to do this. You start with equanimity. You've got to be able to see there's no difference between yourself and everybody else. On that basis, you develop the seven causes of one effect meditation or the equalizing of changing self and other meditation. But so once you do both those, you end up with a mind of enlightenment. Or you can join them. And of course, why? Because you wish to become enlightened for the benefit of others. It's this motivation. But like I said, you know, to get to that, you've got to do equanimity, six forms of one effect, equalizing, exchanging. Now, once you have this mind of enlightenment, now the actual work begins. Now you engage in the six perfections, the four ways of gaining disciples, and the practices of the Vajrayana data. Again, so this is now from the foundation of all good qualities, verse 7. So here Lama Tsongkhapa says, just as I have fallen into the sea of samsara, so have all mother migratory beings. Bless me to see this. Train in supreme bodhicitta and bear the responsibility of freeing migratory beings. So here we're moving from the wish for personal freedom into that sort of courageous determination to secure the lasting happiness of every living being. Basically, the main point is that seeking our own freedom and only that is a limited goal. And this verse and the understanding is that, you know, again, we have to come back and realize that, look, we're all trapped in the same cycles of recurring pain and confusion. We're all the same. In fact, I think it's in, this is in Three Principal Aspects of the Path, where they talk about, you know, there's a child on the river, on a bank river, on the river of bank, and they see their mother swept down a river, and there's a chain, the net over them, and they're inside an iron cage. And this cage is going down the river and banging to all the rocks and things. It's like, what can you do? Yeah, it's a horrible way. What do you do? You just walk away?
Jump in.
Yeah, you would have, but then again, you go like, but if you're a child, it's like, geez, how am I going to save them? You know, like, I'm just a kid. You can't walk away, but you really can't leap in another. So, that's right, but this is a situation we all find ourselves in, right? Anyone who's been with anybody who's really sick, you come up to the thing that, man, what you can do is very limited, isn't it? It comes up to basically just like sitting there. And lucky for us, we've got all sorts of prayers we can do, we've got visualizations we can do. We're not, you know, just lost. We don't have to sit there and worry, because even though we might not be able to do too much with our mouth or our hands, we can do a lot with our mind. And that's very good for us. So I don't know, maybe you guys, you probably haven't heard of this bloke called Russell Cox. So Russell Cox was once Australia's most wanted man. And he broke out of like inescapable prison in Melbourne. He got out. So I knew some people and they told me about how he got out and everything. You know what he did? He went back to break out the other prisons.
Oh, wow.
Did it work?
No.
No,
I couldn't do it. But this is the idea here between the body center, right? Yeah, I'm free. Now I got to help everyone else get free. That's the idea behind it.
But that's why you have to become a Buddha.
That's right.
Can't break your bones up. You don't have a job.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's right.
I was just going to ask you, with that dual motivation to achieve, is it like one is, I want to have self-convenience,
yeah,
and then you ask, how do I do that? I can't do it as I am. I have to become, I want to become a Buddha. Those two.
That's right, those two.
So there is the, I want to help sending means, but recognizing I can't do it. How do I do it?
Yeah. Is it possible to do it? Like, I can't do it like this. Now I want to, but I can't. But is it possible to? And the answer is yes, but to do that, you must become, you know, a fully awakened being. Then you can do it. But of course, you know, you have to also remember how karma plays its role, right? Because, of course, the Buddha can help all limited beings become free. However, the person has to want to become free. If they don't want to become, it doesn't matter what a Buddha says or does or how he behaves, it's not going to happen. So there's this relationship between the sentient beings and the Buddhas. So it's interesting, because Buddhas depend upon sentient beings to become Buddhas. Without sentient beings, we can't have any Buddhas. And yet the sentient beings depend upon the Buddhas to find freedom. So there's this relationship there. So now just, I'll briefly go through what these two different practices that lead to the motivation of the mind of enlightenment. So the first, of course, is called the seven cause and effect instruction. And it's got, like I said, seven parts. So the first part is to recognize all beings as your mother. So I've got recognize all beings as kin, because sometimes you can say, if you have a bad relationship with the mother, what about your father? What about a brother? What about somebody? And what's this to do is to inspire sort of commonality and solidarity amongst all beings. The second step is to recall the kindness of all beings, and this inspires gratitude. The third is to repay their kindness, or resolve to repay that kindness, and this inspires a reciprocity of affection. It's not because others have been affectionate and kind to us, we should do the same. We should respond in the same way. Next one is what they call generate affectionate love, or love and kindness. And this inspires recognition of the value of others being happy. And we generate great compassion, inspiring recognition that all sentient beings deserve to be free from the all-pervasive suffering of samsara. So we practice, it's that deepest level of suffering that we wish to be free of and want to help others. It's not just the suffering of pain, it's not the suffering of change. It's this understanding of how we've grabbed the aggregates, which are actions, suffering, and gone, that's me. I'm that, and all the rest follows. So there's great compassion. Then what they call wholehearted resolve. So this is what Ben was saying, right? So we have this this inspiration to free others from suffering. We really want to, but then this question arises, you know, Can I, as I am? And your answer, if you're really honest with yourself, you go, no, I can't. So then what, you just give up? You go, but you know, can it be done? And we find, yes, but you need to do this first. You need to remove the cognitive obscurations along with the afflictive obscurations. And then we end up with this mind of enlightenment. And this is what they call the seven cause and effect instructions that comes out from Arya Asanga, I think. Then the method is the method from Shantideva called equalizing, exchanging self for others. Now this is made up of five steps, generally, but some of the steps are a little different. But basically, you start off by equalizing self with others. And like I said, this is the equalization where you see, just as I want to be happy, so do you. There's no difference between us. Just as I wish to be free from suffering, so do you. There's no difference between us. Although I wish to be free from suffering, I'm not. Just like you. So we're the same in this way. You said, so what contributes to the suffering? Yeah, well, egocentricity, or what's often called self-cherishing, or sometimes self-importance. There are different words used for the term self-cherishing. I like this particular one because a judge once called me the most egocentric person who ever had appear in his court. And I went, what? Mate, everybody I know is just like me. So we look at the faults of this indifference towards others and just being focused on self. And then we look at the benefits of actually cherishing the other. When we see those benefits, now we can exchange self-concern with the cherishing of others. But just as we used to be, or like we might still be, probably are, primarily concerned about ourselves, right? This is going, okay, now we make the switch because we're the same, right? Now I can be primarily concerned about you.
But isn't that then saying you're still therefore concerned with yourself? Because if you're the same, it's one and the same, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. That's the beauty of it. That's right. So you care for others, you care for yourself. Because there's no difference between self and other.
But then isn't that still caring for yourself?
Yeah, of course it is.
So it's like two things at the same time.
Yeah, so I've read a great thing about this, where this guy, he did so many years in prison in Tibet or China, as a monk, you know. And there are all sorts of different instructions you can get on this practice. But the one that really made a big importance for him was to see that the other was self. Because if you look at, you know, like it's like the one when you do, like from my perspective, you're other and I'm self. But from your perspective, I'm other and yourself. So to care for other is to care for self. And then when we become proficient with this and it makes all sense to us, then we engage in what they call the giving and taking, or the Tonglen practice. So here's this verse that I was mentioning, Madonna. So this is this way of developing bodhicitta, right? Or what they call the great compassion here. And it's summed up mostly in this verse here. So it says, carried away by the torrents of four fierce rivers, bound by tight fetters of karma, difficult to undo, caught up in the iron net of self-grasping, completely enveloped in the pitch black darkness of ignorance. Think about how your mothers feel. Think about what's happening to them. So I guess this is this really interesting thing. He said, this is for developing bodhicitta, but you could take this and apply it to yourself to develop renunciation. Yeah, he says, when these lines are read in relation to our own situation, they give rise to true renunciation. When read in the context of others' suffering, they engender the great compassion. So any idea what the torrents of the four fierce rivers are? There's two ways of looking at it. One's from the cause and one's from the effect. Well, I'll just ask you from the effect point of view.
Sickness, old age, and death.
Yeah. Birth, aging, sickness, and death. Mm-hmm. There's the four torrents that we're in. Yes, the iron net of self-grasping. So, yeah, like an exercise you can do, if you can remember this verse, or even just some of it. So, you know, when you see other people behaving really badly, they're people just like the people in the verse, swept along by the currents. Past karma, the net of self-grasping. And I often think of, like, I'm not sure if it says here, but and when Geshe described this, like, you know, you're in this cage, you've got a net thrown over you, you're going down, you're bumping into rocks and everything like that, and you're going under and you're coming back up. That's how we are. Now, not to stress up on everyone. Everyone is like getting swept away, getting plunged into despair. Yeah. Trying to seek, you know, like thrashing about, trying to be free, often hurting those who are trying to help us. Yeah, so you can have, you know, rather compassion rather than anger. That's the idea, is to have more of this other way of relating to people. To see, look, this is the situation you're in yourself. Everyone's in this situation. Okay, so. Anything interesting you find about what we've just gone through?
I think that last verse does sort of send that message that most people live in a very turbulent state.
Yeah, for sure. Well, yeah, if you watch the news, you can see, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, we can think of these people are all being carried away by these four rivers, the rivers of life. They've all been born. And all aging and suffering and dying. Yeah, that's right. To get away, it's like it's very, very hard. You need a lot of good conditions in place. Yeah? Like for us, we have them in place. But if a person in Palestine or Super Sudan, there's plenty of places all over the world, right? You try and practice the spiritual path is you're just running around trying to get something to eat and drink, let alone avoid people trying to kill you. Like, imagine if this was like this for us, and we're trying to be Buddhist and learn about the path. Well, I don't think we'd all be here tonight, for instance, right? We've got, you know, more important things to do, so to speak. Yeah, so this is the way we're working against the self-cherishing, so we're doing what self-cherishing doesn't want, which is to cherish the other. But we've worked out, like, just cherishing myself alone doesn't work. And I used to say to people, oh, you know, you want to check out what's better, cherishing others or self-cherishing, just go to work and be completely focused on yourself and see what happens.
Yeah.
Right? Not a good outcome usually, is it, right? People don't like you. That's what usually happens, isn't it? You know, then you go, okay, now, next day, go to work and be really concerned about the other. You put yourself second. You know, the same concern you had about yourself the first day, now be that concerned about the others. See what happens.
But is it also the case, the way that you used to not care about others, you apply that to the self-cherishing?
That's why I'm not going to care about the self-cherishing. I can't. By giving self-cherishing what it wanted, that's why I'm in this trouble. But I have to stop doing that. In fact, in 37 Practices of Bodhisattva is a really great section where they talk, they do this thing about looking at the faults of self-cherishing, you know, and they call it a butcher, a murderer, a thief. You know, and then they give this explanation of why they call it that. And you find, yeah, it steals all your happiness and it actually kills your happiness and so forth. And you go, oh, okay, Jesus. So what I find really interesting is you can agree with it, but boy, it's hard to do.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I think it's really hard to do, at least for some, is because if you really want to do it, you have to go right back to the beginning and do equanimity. Because while that's not in place, you are going to have aversion and attachment and self-grasping. So unless that equanimity is in place first of all, you're not going to make any progress. You're going to agree and everything and try and practice the other stuff. It's not going to work. this was my experience. You can do it sometimes, or most times we forget. Yeah, it's just flaky practice. Yeah, there's not no strength in it. And so I do like the particular, you know, there's quite a difference between the equanimity practice and the six forces in one effect, and the equanimity practice and equalizing and exchanging self for others. They're different forms of equanimity. But the form in equalizing and exchanging self for others is the one where you go, just as I want to be happy, so do you. We are the same in that way. Just as I want to avoid suffering, I know you do too, so we're the same. So we're equal. And then the song, although I have this wish to be free from suffering and want to be happy, I'm not. Just like you. So here we are the same. Yeah, so we get this sense of equanimity, and then we move on to the other one. So I just forget about, so but each type of equanimity, they're developing different ways of different emotional responses, different psychological responses to people. Okay, so let's do our last meditation. So again, adjust the posture, drop the shoulders, lengthen the spine, and just check that your head is evenly balanced on the neck. Then allow your eyes to close or be partially open. And let the body breathe itself. And just breathe deeply and let the days, the weight of the day, vanish as the body grows still. And to set your heart on the full freedom of every living being. So having a state of inner peace and equilibrium is your working base. But the state of peace that you experience there, you could think of it as being a gift for everyone. So being at ease, this alone, is not enough to reach full awakening. You need a heart that cares deeply for others. So the wish to be free or renunciation is like a map. But love for others is the light that shows you how to move across that map. So what stops you from feeling others' pain as much as you feel your own? Well, many of us are averse to pain, and this blinds us to the deep bond that we share with others. And this aversion or blindness hides how much we share with those caught in the same cycle of confusion and loss. Well, so why is achieving a state of singular peace not enough? It's not enough because we will be leaving the others that we care for behind. All of us want joy in the same way. So our own state of peace and happiness is tied to that of others. But true freedom is like a prisoner who finds their cell door open. He goes out and it opens the door of every other cell. So how can we turn our daily states of confusion and stress into a source of care and strength? We have to try to make each act we engage in a gift for others. Now think of one person you'd like to help right now. Then imagine helping them. So what's that feel like? Now breathing in through your nostrils. Exhale. And bring your attention back to the room. So today we looked at the practices for a person of great capacity, and in particular, practice of a wishing bodhicitta. And this was discussed in verse 7 of the Dharma Tsongkhapa's Foundation of All Good Qualities. So between now and then, if you find any material on this, have a read of it. So this material would include meditating using the six causes and one effect, using six causes and effect, or the equalizer exchanging self for others. There's lots of material on this in any of the books. And then, if you'd like to, you can. Progress memorizes verse 10 to 12. And we'll be going through these in the next couple of weeks. And like I said, next week we'll look at the engaging practices of those. So these, of course, are the six perfections, the four ways of working with others. And okay, just the end of our class today. So that something was useful. Let's dedicate to what we've done. So please join me in saying, due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the Supreme Guru, Bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to the smell of the sorrows of the world. And in the prayer for the long life continues, the wish granted, the wish to put endure, source of every single benefit and happiness of this world. To the incomparably kind attention, Gatsa, I beseech that all the whole wishes please, my dreams and prayers. And lastly, the prayer for Rinpoche's swift return. In holding and spreading the Buddha's precious and complete teachings for explanation and practice, you wore the armor of patience and have never discouraged. Incomparable, venerable Guru, to you, and make this request.